Welcome to the P3 Pilates Progressions Program, brought to you by Personalized Pilates. If you would like more information about the whole P3 program, please visit www.personalizedpilates.com. I'm Katrina Foe, your host for tonight. I'm a second-generation Pilates master teacher trainer, and I'm here to answer all your Pilates and anatomy questions so that you can take your Pilates teaching to the next level.
Welcome. Tonight, I'm going to start out with a beautiful letter that one of our P3ers sent me. It was really kind, so I wanted to just share it with y'all. She wrote, "Hi, Katrina. I began P3 through Larry last September and just finished up the program. Back in 2007, I graduated Michelle Larson's Core Dynamics Pilates program. However, I was dancing professionally at the time, so I did not see very many weekly clients, probably about 10 a week. In the past year, I have mostly retired from dancing, so I have grown my client base to about 25 per week. Your P3 program has truly been a wonderful addition to my continuing education and has motivated me immensely. Although I have been teaching for a while, P3 has helped fill in some gaps in my training, either because I went through comprehensive training so long ago or because the training was just different. If you take a glass jar and fill it up with rocks, I feel like my comprehensive training is those rocks. My continuing education, POT, weekend workshops, etc., would be a lot of pebbles sprinkled in there to help fill some of the big holes that the rocks make. And then P3 would be the sand that's poured in to fill the cracks. Thanks to you and Larry for creating this program in its entirety. I'm very grateful that you share your experience in your own continuously growing education so freely with your clients, trainees, and everyone else. Your passion for teaching Pilates and educating others is contagious. Thank you for rekindling my love for Pilates and for giving me another wonderful springboard from which to share my personal knowledge and experiences with my clients and students. I look forward to P3 Level 2. Many thanks again." Okay, so I just wanted to share that. She ended with a question. She wrote, "Since I'm not a local, what kind of certificate of completion should I expect to receive?" I just wanted to mention that all the people in our P3 program, if you fully complete the program, you'll get a certificate saying you're a third-generation instructor because you have been trained by me. Again, the major thing that we're looking for is the completion of the quizzes and such, which this particular person did a great job with. So you will be getting one of those. If you have other questions like that, let me know. And I love hearing feedback on how the P3 program has helped you. A lot of the P3 participants are far away, and I don't ever get to meet them personally, but I get to hear your questions, and you obviously get to hear from me all the different, you know, aspects of the P3 program with the podcasts and the lectures and all that kind of such. So it feels like we're friends and close, but we don't necessarily. So it's really great to hear specific things like that and what is affecting you and what you find helpful. Okay, so the next thing that I wanted to do, we had quite a few questions today about logistics, about anatomy and different exercises, so I wanted to just jump right into some of those. Here's the first one. "Hi, Katrina. I have a question regarding first position footwork. I cue the client's heels to be lifted so they're lengthening their entire body. If this is wrong, please correct me. Smiley face. I see many clients keeping their heels together, but the heels sink under or in line with the foot bar. If I cue higher heels, they can't press out to straight legs and keep their high heels together at the same time. Can you explain why this happens? It also happens during stomach massage." This is a great question. Okay, so basically, if you put your person upright, so have them, you know, do this from standing, not on the reformer, it's going to be the same thing. So if you have them stand in what we call Pilates first, which is kind of a not super turned out ballet first, so it's like a V with your feet, okay? So we're not looking to get, like, straight across like a professional ballerina would get or anything like that, and even they don't actually get straight across. So it's a slight V, heels together, toes apart. If they start, what you're doing is called, what you're cueing is called a releve. So they lift their heels off the ground and they're on the balls of their feet. Okay, so in that position with their legs straight, you'll notice that there should be a gap between their heels of probably about 3 or 4 inches, give or take, depending on how long specifically their feet are. Okay, so what's happening there is you're shifting from the center of the foot, where the center of the weight is going, when they're standing on their foot flat, to on the ball of their foot. And there's going to be a couple inch difference on both feet. So you add that together and you get 3 or 4 inches. Again, those are approximate measurements, and it depends on the length of the foot and, you know, where they hold their center of gravity and such like that. So when you put that on the reformer, if you're starting in the releve position with the knees bent, heels high, they can't keep those heels together when they straighten their legs, just like you can't keep the heels together when you're in a releve standing. It's just, it doesn't work logistically. So traditionally what we do in Pilates is when you're doing the first position, the heels are actually in line with the foot bar, approximately. It doesn't have to be perfect. So that when you, the instructor, are looking kind of on down that bird's eye view on the reformer, their feet are flat. So it's like they're standing on the ground. Okay, and then they're going to be doing the releve, so the heels lifting up. And because of this positioning of the heels and the feet, and they're not in this on-the-ground position, they are going to be able to keep their heels together better, not perfect. And so the way that you can actually cue them to get the heels together and keep the heels together, which is much easier on the reformer than standing up, which you'll notice as soon as you try this, is to get that external rotation. So this is not glutes. If they clench their glutes at this point, meaning glute max, it's going to cause a bulge under their pelvis because their butt is going to puff up, so to speak, plump up when the muscles contract. And that's not what we're looking for. That's going to just shift the pelvis and put more strain on some of the other joints. What we're looking for is the deep external hip rotators. So there's 6 of them, the piriformis, the gemellus, the obturators, and those are what we're looking for to turn on and from a deep. Now, it feels like it's deep in the butt, okay, but it's not butt cheek, the more superficial glute max. And that's a very, very key thing to find. So it should be heels in line with the foot bar approximately. Now, if you want to do high heels, that exercise is really often called the heel lifts and such. That's traditionally done in a parallel position, so it's not turned out. And what you're focusing is on getting ankle movement. And so, again, there's subtle differences with what you're focusing on in these different footwork variations. And that's why I think it's very important to get a variety of them, not all in one day, but you do different ones, different days. Don't always do the same ones. And a lot of times us instructors tend to find one or two we like that works great on our body, and that's just what our clients always get. And I've heard clients that have been taking lessons for a long time be like, oh, I've never seen that. I had no idea there was a foot position like that. And there may be a reason that their instructor may have been working on something specific for their body. But a good variety is important because it does do different things. And that's where, as you become more proficient as an instructor, you can pick which ones you want to do with that client that day based on the imbalances and such that you see, the areas that they need to work on getting movement or stabilizing or lengthening or whatever. I'm going to throw a little opinion in my experience out there, and this may have nothing to do with you, but I have seen this a lot in the exercises that have a lot of variations. So footwork obviously is one of them. But there's a lot of exercises that have, like, you know, 10 variations and such. And this commonly happens where instructors will start to meld the variations together. And especially if the instructor in the early part of their training is not working with a lot of other instructors and really going over their material a lot, maybe auditing the training modules and such, watching the videos, it's very, very easy to combine them in their head, and then they combine them in their teaching, or they forget little details. I'll be really honest. I remember, I think I've mentioned this before, When I was first training, totally forgot that in chest expansion there's this head turn thing, and I was doing it and teaching it without it. Now, is it going to hurt the client? No, and neither is what you're describing. It's not going to hurt the client, but you may frustrate them if you're telling them to do something that they probably can't, kind of a thing. Now, I remember, you know, going back in my books, and all of a sudden I discovered, and it was like this, oh, whoops, totally forgot about that. And then it was like I remembered it. I'm just grateful that I noticed that early in my teaching, within, you know, a couple months of it and stuff. But again, a lot of times that happens, and it goes unnoticed for a long time. And there's just a lot of exercises, let's be honest, in those modules. There's so much choreography, and especially if you are not super familiar with the choreography, it can be very, very overwhelming. And it's doing teacher training, one of the hardest things that we can explain to people before they do the training is that the more the choreography they know going in, the more they will get out of the training. And what I mean by that is if you go into the training already knowing the exercises, all the exercises would be awesome, but knowing like maybe 75% of them, what's going to happen is in the modules, you will start to learn the nuances, and you'll start to see the variations, the modifications, and the teaching cues, and the tactile adjustments, and the, you know, contraindications and stuff like that, because you can pick up on that stuff, versus just spending all your time in the teaching modules learning the basic choreography. And let's face it, unless you're a dancer or a gymnast or such, where you're used to having to pick up choreography quickly, that is a really hard skill. And that's something that dancers develop and work on over time, is how to learn and remember movement patterns extensively. So trying to teach yourself not only all these movement patterns, but how to remember them all, and then think of all the different, you know, information for about teaching that goes with it, you're not going to get it all out. And that's why at Personalized Pilates, when we do the training modules, when people are going through the P3 program in conjunction with the training modules, we let them audit it for free. And we have a small fee if people are, you know, not in all those things. But it's really important because there's no way, no one gets all the information out of the module the first time. It's just too much information. And if you, again, if you know the choreography, you'll get a lot more out of it. So the more classes you can take and lessons, private lessons that you can take in Pilates before you go through teacher training, the better. And it's really hard to convince people of this. So if you have friends that are going through teacher training or thinking about it, encourage them to know a lot and learn a lot and do a lot, practice it a lot beforehand. And you could give them lessons. That would be awesome. You know, just to help them prepare for it. Okay, total bunny trail from this question. So I just want to go back to that and reiterate that first position footwork, heels together, toes apart, balls of the feet are on the bar. Heels are pretty much right under the balls of the feet, so it's like they're standing on a flat surface, but they're just standing on this little bar. And then they're going to bend their knees completely, keeping the heels together, and they're going to straighten the legs completely, okay? And so what we're looking for is movement at the hip joint and knee joint and ankle joint. We're not keeping the length through the entire body. We're purposely trying to get some folds. Think of an accordion kind of thing in the legs. As they do this, my favorite cue, when people aren't able to keep their heels together with the heels in line with the balls of the feet, is, you know, first off, I mentioned, by the way, I'd like you to try to keep your heels together. And just drawing their attention to this is huge. Again, first priority is going to be that pelvis, but this is, you know, a close second. So there's a lot of inner thigh connection that should be going on there that people, I've talked on several shows recently about how weak that connection is for most people, and that's a very common, very important imbalance that goes on. So that, bringing their attention to that is one way of helping. The other thing that's going on there, again, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, is the deep external hip rotators. There's six of them. They're small guys. They're not sexy and talked about a whole lot, much less by name. And so you want to really make sure that they can find them without clenching the butt cheeks. Okay, so this isn't a butt cheek thing. Glute max is much larger, and especially it's very different in terms of what it does, even though they on a muscle action list, they both list external rotation. They're very different in the subtleties and how they do it. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in a minute with the next question. So my other cue, once you've brought it to their attention and they're still not getting it, so to speak, what you want to do then is, this is quick and dirty, bring their attention to it with some kind of a tactile sensation. So if I'm really lazy, I will just stick my fingers kind of one on top, one on bottom of their heel, when their heels are together, and say, don't lose my fingers. Kind of, you know, they're not going to hurt me by squeezing it, kind of a thing, but my fingers are kind of in between their heels, not fully, but partially, if that makes any sense. The better way to do this is to put like a sticky, usually there's stickies sitting close to the foot bar or something that you can grab, or a hand towel or anything that's small. You could do a piece of paper, although I think the traction on the sticky and the towel lend something to the exercise. Put it between the heels, and you as the instructor are going to gently pull on that upwards towards the ceiling. So as they're going out and in doing their footwork, you're going to say, don't let me have this. You know, and you can make jokes about it and stuff like I usually do, or you could be very serious, and you're just trying to gently pull. You're not really trying to rip it away, but what you're doing is giving them some feedback as soon as they start to lose the connection, to whoop, get that connection. And the first time, usually, bam, you've got that thing out between their heels like nobody's business. And they usually giggle, and then you put it back in, and the second time they do it, they can do it better. And then the third time, by the fourth or fifth time, you can't get that away if you try really hard. Okay, and that's what you're trying to accomplish, is you're drawing their attention to what you want them to do with some tactile feedback on their body as to how it should feel, and that they're not doing it, or they are doing it. And that's what Pilates is all about. So that's what a prop is. So whether you want to call a sticky an official prop, I don't know. That's up to you. But it's a really great tool for that. And again, anything that's real thin that you could stick through the heels, I wouldn't recommend a ball, because the ball is going to introduce a gap. So you're going to have to scoot the balls of their feet a little farther apart. But it isn't terrible if you absolutely don't have anything else, because they still will drop the ball as they go out if they don't keep that inner thigh and deep external hip rotator connection. Okay, so hopefully that answers your question, and I would recommend trying to separate the high heel heel lift variation with the first position variation, and I think you will enjoy it much more, and I think you won't be quite as frustrated. So same thing during stomach massage. Basically, stomach massage is the exact same exercise as footwork. Okay, so bear with me if this is going to blow your brain. It's the same thing, except at the hip joint up, you're vertical instead of supine. Okay, so everything that's going on really should be the same, except now you have this additional component of your abs pulling your chest, trying to stay over and past your hips while you're doing it versus just laying there. And that's why we definitely would do stomach massage after the footwork, because it's more difficult, it's more complex. But this is another great example of how Pilates exercises build on one another. They're the same movement patterns, and then we add a twist or, you know, something to it to make it more complex and more difficult, to see if the client got it and to challenge the client in a different way. And this is why we don't ever do sets of the same exercise. And you'll see this quite often at beginning level trainings, where people that have been personal trainers just can't seem to not do three sets of something. And I'm like, okay, we're going to get three sets within the whole workout. It's just not called the same exercise, and there's variations on it, okay? So, you know, the 100 is the same thing as the series of fives, the same thing as coordination, is the same thing as backstroke. They're all basically the same exercise. You just have different arms and legs, right? So this is kind of the same thing. In terms of the leg and lower body work, it should be the same thing. You just have this added complexity of the upper body being upright. So that's why it also happens during stomach massage. You are not crazy. You are profoundly smart to notice that connection, and I applaud you at that. Okay, I'm going to throw out the next question. This actually is also about stomach massage, which is why it goes perfectly right after that. Get some little lead-in transitions there. All right, she wrote, in the stomach massage, why do clients' knees turn in when they lower their heels under the bar? Is it because they're not engaging glute medius? Should I cue, quote, squeeze the glutes when they lower their heels? Good questions. Okay, so I'm going to answer this all kind of together because it's very related. So in stomach massage, like we were just talking about, one of the common things that they do wrong, clients, is that when they lower their heels under the bar, they don't keep the heel connection. Okay, so when they don't keep the heel connection, what this looks like is what this instructor is describing, is they lose the external rotation and they go into more of a parallel position, so their knees are going from pointing out to pointing, like, up, so it's turning in. I don't know that their knees, at least the clients that I've trained, don't usually actually go into full internal rotation at the hip where the knees touch each other or anything, which this question kind of alludes to, but I don't think that's what you meant. They lose that external rotation. And this is the same thing. So this has to do with lack of an inner thigh connection and the deep external hip rotators. Okay, I would use the exact same cues in terms of I would draw their attention to it first. I would probably make a correlation connection to the footwork that they did earlier that day. Or maybe if I see it going on one day, the next day I'll talk about in footwork, you know, and really focus on the first position and say, okay, we're going to do stomach massage later. This is going to be important again. This is the same thing. So remember this, you know, connecting exercises together for clients is super important and can really help them just skyrocket their progress, because all of a sudden it's not just these random things that are seemingly completely unconnected. They start to see connections and patterns in movement, and the more they understand that, the more their body is going to start to understand it. All right, so is it because they're not engaging glute med? No. Glute medius' main job is to do abduction, so that's opening the legs up. And while their feet are in a closed chain, so their balls of their feet are fixed, they can't move them, it's not really, if that was not the case, that their legs would go flying open. It's really that they lost the inner connection of their inner thighs, the opposite thing. If you cued squeeze the glutes, what would happen? Yeah, I don't think it would actually help them keep their heels together at all. The glutes, it's kind of a weird cue. When you say squeeze the glutes, what actually happens with clients is they connect with glute max, and it's not this whole, like, all the glutes, like the term implies, meaning you're not going to get minimus and medius connecting on a cue like that. It's going to be maximus. And so it's got to squeeze the butt cheeks together, like, you know, like there's a quarter in between your crack and you're trying to hold on to it. That's what you're going to get, and that's actually not going to be very effective, and it's going to be very, very difficult for the client to attain in that position, because in the stomach massage position, they actually have a lot of hip flexion. And glute maximus actually does hip extension, so he's not going to work very well, if at all, in that super flexed position. So basically your knees are touching your chest most of stomach massage, at least on the in phase of the carriage, and it's not going to do much. So like if you cue it, try it on yourself. When you're doing stomach massage, try to squeeze your butt cheeks together and squeeze your glutes. You are going to feel kind of frustrated probably because you're in that super flexed hip position and it doesn't function very effectively there. It's not its powerful zone. If you will, glute max actually works best in extension, external rotation, okay? So that's what it's working on to do that. So think like swan or something like that where it's really opening or really working on that. Most of the time you don't need to cue glutes, I think, in my opinion, ever, for most people. They usually do that very, very naturally. Every once in a while you'll find somebody that is very Usually there's been some kind of trauma to the back or something, the sacrum area, or, you know, they've got some kind of weird movement pattern where they're not working very well, but most of the time it's not that. And I really want to stress that, because you will hear that cue used, overused, in Pilates world a lot. A lot of the, I hate to stereotype people, but that's what this is. A lot of the Ramana-trained lineage people cue that on everything. It's like literally you squeeze your butt cheeks when you walk in the studio and you don't let go until you leave the studio. And what I have found in terms of movement is that it really locks your pelvis up and you lose movement, not gain it. Okay, now, so to me, that cue is way overused. For me personally, I'm a reformed glute clencher. You know, I was a dancer, and that was how I stabilized my pelvis, was clenching my glutes. I had no idea about my abs growing up, and that's what I did instead. And that's usually what people are doing. And so for me, it took probably, I would say, like a year of trying to learn how to turn them off, not on. So I kind of had the opposite problem. Now, I won't say that everybody has this problem, but I will say that a lot of clients I see tend to fall in my camp, not the other camp. So how can you tell this? I think that one of the easiest ways is to have them do something like a bridge, just a simple, plain mat bridge. I don't care if it's articulating spine or flat back, but when they go up and down, can they do it by using their abdominals and their hamstrings versus their glutes? Now, I'm not saying using your glutes is bad or it's going to hurt you. I think it's a great exercise, but can they distinguish between what does the exercise? So, you know, you can have them do it, and it's great because their hands are free and it's right by their butt, and you can just have them at the top of the bridge, you know, say, grab your butt. Is it hard as a rock or can you jiggle it? You know, basically, if I come over there and flick your butt cheek, it should jiggle and wobble, and usually they laugh. I had a side note. I had a client once that thought that was just so funny. She went home and told her husband that, which makes me laugh. And he said, well, you know, if Katrina needs somebody to come in and flick butts, I could help with that. Needless to say, we did not have him come in and flick butts. But my point in this story is that the butt cheeks should not always have to be on. They should be able to turn on and off depending on what the exercises you're doing and what the purpose is. And you should have control over that. I mean, that's what Joe talked about is, you know, he called his work contrology. It's the study of control. Can you choose what muscle works and what doesn't work? Can you choose where your body goes, or does it just do it on its own and you are at the mercy of what it is able to do and wants to do without you being in charge? And that's where we're trying to help empower our clients. So then to oversimplify this, one of the things that I look for as a teacher, any time that a client can't do something, you can pretty well guess that there's something going on wrong there in terms of muscle firing and muscle action, and that's what you want to work on. Okay, so if you have a client that can't do this or can't do that, you got to especially love it when they preface it and tell you, oh, no, I can't do that. There's something going on. Now, whether you want to proceed and push through it, you know, has a lot to do with, is it in pain or is it just I'm not able to physically cannot perform that? That's two different questions, and I'm not saying at all that you should have them push through something they can't do into a pain zone. Please hear me straight. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that that's giving you an indicator that there's something wrong there, and you should look for the imbalance very carefully because there is a muscle imbalance, if not more than one. Okay, so going back to stomach massage, not glute med, it's more inner thighs and deep external hip rotators. So one of my quick and dirty ways to find the deep external hip rotators, because we talked about this on the first question here and then now again on this question, this is my quick go-to. I have them stand up, heels together, toes apart, so they're standing in first position. If they have really bad balance, you can have them gently hold on to something but not a death clinch. And they're going to rise up into a releve and keep their heels squeezing together as if their life depended on it. Now, they're not going to go up into a full releve. They're going to go about 1 inch off the floor with their heels. Okay, so they're barely hovering. Now, in this position, have them grab with their hand their butt cheeks, and again, it should be jiggly. Okay, so if they can't do that, back up, have them start again, and try to find where they can do that without clenching their butt cheeks. Okay, so again, if they can't not clench their butt cheeks, there's a big indicator that something's wrong and they need to learn how to not clench their butt cheeks. But what you'll find is it feels like butt cheeks, but you can get the floppy butt cheeks. And what that is that's a combination of those six deep external hip rotators, which are so important in Pilates. So we're going to use those in a lot of different exercises, and they're very important. And it's very important that they actually feel the difference between glute max and the six deep external hip rotators. So very, very important. I don't think I can emphasize that enough. Another exercise that I love in terms of finding this is the frog lying flat on the chair. And the reason this works so well is because it's one of the few exercises that you do with external hip rotation, and you're in hip flexion. Okay, so the glute max pretty much can't work in this position because, like I mentioned before when we were talking about stomach massage, glute max is a hip extensor. It extends the hip. So if you're flexed as much as you can or close to it, it's not going to have much power, and it's going to be a lot easier to turn it off, and so you can find those six deep external hip rotators. For those of you that might be studying for tests, I will just remind you the six deep external hip rotators are piriformis, which is usually the one everyone knows the best because he actually crosses two joints. He crosses the SI joint as well as the hip joint, and that's where he gets his bad reputation because he causes problems when he crosses the SI joint. Then we have the superior and inferior gemellus, and we have the obturator internus and externus, and then we have quadratus femoris. So those are your six. Just for fun, in case you were wondering, because I know a lot of you guys are studying for the PMA test and such like that. Okay, I think that's pretty much all I want to say. Oh, you know what? I'm going to continue on that frog lying flat. One thing is, a lot of times when people teach this exercise, they don't necessarily do it with as much external rotation as they can, and that's not a bad variation. But if you really want to ensure that they find the deep external hip rotators, open those legs as if they're opening a book. So you want the book of, you know, each leg to lie flat on the floor if possible. And so you're really pressing open for that deep external hip rotation as you pump the pedal up and down, if that makes sense. Pretty key there for that. Okay, so hopefully that wraps up the questions on the stomach massage. Once they have found those deep external hip rotators in the fully externally rotated position of the hip, it's going to be much easier to find them and have control of them and access to them, just because neuromuscularly you've connected to them in lots of other positions. So things like the stomach massage, where we are not opening their legs any wider than like shoulder distance, they'll still feel it and be able to find them better, so it feels like their butt, but it's not glute max. Okay, so that's really confusing, and this question is awesome because it's very, very confusing for a lot of people, that distinguishing feature, whether is it glute max or is it the deep rotators. And I'll tell you, that's one of the things that I hear miscued probably one of the most, I'd say definitely top five, in Pilates studios by the instructors. It's a very commonly misunderstood concept anatomically. It does feel very similar, but it's much, much deeper. It feels like it's in the socket, which it literally is, because if you look on an anatomical chart, the muscles, the six deep ones, they are very, very deep. They're like in the socket, versus glute max is very, very superficial. Now, glute max makes the big bulb J-Lo butt, you know, aesthetically, but the deep external hip rotators actually add a lot of the contour and the lift, and specifically will help with the definition of the gluteal fold. That just sounds fun, right? That's the crease under your butt, plumpness part. Also, developing your hamstrings really will accentuate that as well. And so, again, a lot of people, they want to work on their butt, and they just focus on glute max all day long. And you really got to look at what does the client need functionally to make their hips work well, and the aesthetics will come as a secondary thing. If you focus on the aesthetics and just do what, you know, the fitness magazine says to do to have a great butt, and just do, like, lots of, you know, extension, butt cheek clenches and squeeze the glute stuff, it doesn't always work. And a lot of times, it, depending on what you had imbalance-wise to start with, it could actually contribute to back pain and hip dysfunctions, particularly hip flexor issues and such. So you want to be careful with that aesthetic training and that mindset. You want to really focus on where is the imbalance, where is the weak spot, not what is going to look good in my jeans. Now, that's your job as the instructor. The client may or may not understand that, and that is something you can educate them as you go with your lovely value-adding statements that we talk about and your goal-setting vision casting that we go over in P3. But you really want to help them grasp that on several levels at the same time, making their butt look better. And quite frankly, this sounds terrible, but a lot of clients, if they feel something generally in the backside of their butt burning, they don't really care what muscle is. They just think it's going to help their butt look good. And that can work to your advantage, because then you can do what's good for their body while they think you're working their glutes. And their butt will look better, but they don't have to work glute max, if that makes sense. So sneaky training, if you will. I say that because you got to remember our studio is in Scottsdale, and people are very, very aesthetically focused usually when they come in. So that education component of teaching people about how to help their body and how what is right for their body and muscular imbalances is a very big uphill battle versus against the aesthetic training. Okay. Hopefully that answered that question fully. A couple bunny trails there. Let me know if you need any more detail on any of this stuff. Remember, always just send me a little email. I'm going to jump to another question here, a little feedback. So the last couple weeks we've been talking to an instructor about her SI joint, and she just has a little update. She said, "My sacral area is continuing to improve. My husband and I drove 6 hours to visit our daughter and her family this past weekend, and I could actually stand upright when I got out of the car. This is very exciting. In the past, I would walk around bent over like a little old lady until my muscles stopped spasming. I still carry the tennis ball with me in my purse. I've been using it less because I can engage the muscles without the tennis ball now. I did, however, use it during my long trip in the car. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for your great suggestions." You are totally welcome, and I am so excited to hear of your great progress. And you clearly figured out that that was your imbalance and are actively working on it in lots of different settings, which I think is fabulous. I also want to highlight for everybody what we had talked about before and just really emphasize. She said she's using it less because she can engage the muscles without the tennis ball now. So just a reminder, like we had mentioned with the sticky on the footwork and stuff, those balls and stickies and all the props, toys, if you will, are there to give you tactile feedback to help find muscles that are lost in Never Never Land and bring them back under your reign to control them. But they're not the exercise. So eventually, as she's alluding to, she will not need the tennis ball at all. And I think that's pretty close at hand, because she can find it herself. That means that muscles are getting stronger, specifically the neuromuscular connection. So the nerve impulses are strengthening down to that muscle. You're actually creating probably new nerves and stronger signals with those nerves. So the muscles are more under control. It's stronger firing signals, and there's actually just more power in those muscles because they've been being used quite a bit. So you're reversing the imbalance on multiple levels, not just strengthening kind of thing, which is good in and of itself. I just want to mention the neurological connection, which is awesome, and that's what that tactile cue of having that feedback of a ball or a sticky or something there is supposed to do, and that's his point. Okay. Next question. Concerning downstretch from class 11 on the tower. Okay, so this is not a classical exercise. I just want to remind everyone. This is a Katrina little variation. So we took a classical exercise of downstretch, which is usually done in the reformer, and we put it somewhere else. And last week, I believe, somebody had, this lady particularly, had some questions about it, and we talked it through. She wrote, "This is a deceptively challenging exercise. After listening to you last week, I played with the movement more. I realized I was trying to bring the push-through bar too close to my body while it was an extension from my knees to my chest, like when I do downstretch on the reformer with my hands in the foot bar. On the reformer, our body comes right up against the foot bar with the pubic bone pressing forward and the back and hips in a lengthened extension, and our hands are under our shoulders. In the downstretch in the tower, this is not the case." Very nice, well put. Exactly. I totally want to agree with you that this is a very different exercise, and yet it's the same thing. So it's really interesting how you're working the same exact movements, so it looks the same from the outside, like from an instructor standing there, and you're working the same muscles and same movements, and the same joints are moving, opening, and closing and such. Still core work, and that's the primary focus, is to keep that low back lengthened, really focus on that core. So while you're in extension, you're thinking posterior tilt of the pelvis to minimize the extension in that hyperlordotic area. Okay, so rewind that and listen to that again if it threw your head first spin. So they're both doing that. However, because the springs and the moving parts are different, it puts a very different force emphasis on the body, and in this case, it's much more difficult. So if somebody's having a hard time, like I mentioned last time, with the downstretch on the reformer, don't go here yet. Master that one first. If this is the first time they've done the downstretch, I recommend teaching on the reformer first because it's a little easier. And all that to say, the reformer downstretch is not easy. I mean, that's probably one of the exercises that I find is most difficult for instructors to teach because they don't know how to cue the client to not be in their low back. Okay, so here's the key. And I don't think for a second that this particular instructor doesn't get this. I just want to emphasize this for everybody else. The key to teaching downstretch either place is to really focus on the front of the hip flexors opening. Okay, so another way of saying that, same thing, different opposite side of the coin, is to posteriorly tilt the pelvis. Okay, so when you posteriorly tilt the pelvis, it opens the front of the hips, it opens the low back, and that's where you want it. Most people, if they have any history of low back, tension, pain, for lack of a technical term, they will do the opposite and make it worse for themselves. Okay, and this is where you kind of like, what? Why are you doing this? This hurts you. Do what I say, people, right? So the cueing is very, very important here, and I think there's a very important level of trust that is built in your Pilates instructor if somebody has a history of pain and low back junk before you do the downstretch. I also want to emphasize, which I don't think I mentioned last week, that the video on the P3 site, this particular instructor mentioned how Larry makes it look easy. He makes it look easy, but he really doesn't look like he's an extension. Okay, so I want to emphasize that this should be done in extension, and Larry's not a very extendy person. That's totally not a word, but I think you know what I'm saying. He does not have a lot of extension in him. So, again, it just looks different on him than it's going to look on most of you. And I just want to make that clear because it looks like, from the video, that he's in like a push-up position, like a neutral spine, neutral everything. And what he feels is not what it looks like there. He feels like he's in a lot of extension. The way, if you were watching that video, I would encourage him or any client is once they've got that front of the hips open, pubic bone zipping up to their chin, low back open, all that, you know, however you want to say it. Those are all talking about the same thing. So they're not feeling any crunchy, grindy stuff in their low back. They've got their core, that is stabilizing in extension, once they have that, then I want them to add the upper back extension. And I mean really add it. Now, for some of you that are like ballerina gymnast type, you're going to be thinking about reaching up like your breastbone is lifting to the ceiling to the point of where if you have long hair, your ponytail might be touching your feet. Not very many of us do that. I don't do that. I'm just going to say the excuse because my hair is not long enough, but that's not really it. I'm not that bendy. But that's the direction you're going. So work within what your body can and should do, and you can do healthfully, but I want you to understand that's the movement that you're going towards. And it's way harder here, and it's really challenging that core stability in an extended position, which, again, if they don't have core stability in a non-extended position, like a neutral position, it's going to be much more difficult. You always want to get it in neutral first and then slowly move further and further from neutral, both flexion and extension. And the farther you are from neutral and they're able to stabilize, in my opinion, that is a great assessment of how advanced you are as a Pilatista, a Pilates practicer. I'm sorry, that's not even a word either. I'm just making things up today. All right, we're going to move on with the next question with that one. All right, she wrote, I am a science teacher at a high school, and I have been teaching a 30-minute mat class for the past 6 weeks on Tuesdays and Thursdays after school. I have a very nice, steady group of 15 to 20 women who come to this class. I use Joe's book, Return to Life, as my guide for exercises and sequencing. I'm learning so much about his mat exercises from this book. I try to picture back what it was like for him and William John Miller to put his book together in 1945. I've tried to find information about the man, Mr. Miller, and his role in the book. Parentheses, I'm assuming he helped Joe write out the pages of text before the exercises since Joe didn't speak English fluently. And also the technical text used to describe the exercises, since it was George Hoining, I'm not even going to say it, Hune, the last name, who photographed the movements. Also, is there any known historical information as to the significance of Joe's tattoos? Okay, so I'm sorry to tell you, I don't have much information about either William John Miller or the photographer. I'm not going to try to slaughter his name again. It's not really ever mentioned, and everything that I've tried to dig up, I don't really find anything except that he was just the co-author in The Return to Life. So in terms of the mat exercise book, the book with the mat exercises, I would think that your guess is probably good that he maybe helped Joe with some of the wording and such. That would be my guess. But again, I don't have anything to back that up, and I haven't been able to find anything more about him. So we really don't know. I mean, maybe he was a client. Maybe he was a fellow Pilates, somebody he had trained. I have no idea. Okay, now about his tattoos. There's not really much known about his tattoos except that you can see them in a lot of the pictures. Joe was famous for taking pictures with himself of himself with just those little white breeches and maybe his ballet shoes on. And so you can see most of his skin, and he had some tattoos. Most of the pictures, you can't see them up close very well. I have no idea when he got them or what they're of or anything like that. And I don't know that there's any significance to them. I do want to mention that Joe is a regular guy. So Joe, if you remember from our history lecture in the P3 program where I went in depth about him, he had two wives. He left his first wife, and he never married his second wife. He left his kids, back in Germany. He drank a lot of whiskey. He smoked cigars. There's tons of pictures of him with the big old fat cigar in his mouth, and that's Joe. He was not perfect. He was not God. He had a brilliant mind and loved studying the body and seeing it move. But like everyone, we all have our sins and our vices, and he did too. So I'm just going to guess that the tattoo had to do with him being a real person, and he had, something in his life that he cared about and wanted to tattoo on him, whatever. I don't know when he got it. most tattoos are when you're younger, but that does not necessarily mean anything. I love the fact that Joe is a real guy. I love the fact that while I, of course, you know, I don't think cigar smoking and whiskey drinking is obviously healthy, nor tattoos. I mean, they're not going to kill you, and a lot of people, everybody has their vices. You know, I think we can all think and say, yep, I know what mine are. And while we're all working towards health and we may know that something is bad for us, sometimes you just have those days where you just need a little, you know, grace, a little release. You know, the kids are being crazy, or, you know, something fell through business-wise, or, you know, some client yelled at you or something. And you know what? Just taking it easy for a little bit, whether it's a nice glass of wine or, you know, a good book or, you know, whatever it is, everybody's got their thing. So I don't know if there's any significance to Joe's tattoos except what I'm attaching to it, in that he was a real person. And I think it's really good to remember that and keep that in perspective. I think it's also really good to remember and keep in perspective that his work was constantly evolving. He was adding new pieces of equipment, refining his equipment, changing it. I mean, look how many versions of the tower there are. There's the Cadillac, there's the tower, there's the guillotine tower, there's the wall unit. I mean, there's so many different, and they're all the same but different completely. So he was constantly working on his method and refining it. It was not done at any point. He loved the work, but he was, you know, a person. And it's important to remember that, because as we work on our journey, we learn and we grow and we refine, but we're still not perfect. And I don't know everything, and neither do you, and unfortunately we never will, which I think is good to ground us in the fact that we are not held accountable to knowing everything, and we're just going to do the best we can with what we know. All right, I've got, I think, time for one more question, so I'm going to jump right in. This one looks like it'll be a good amount of time. She wrote, when I'm doing arabesque on the reformer, which I love as a hip opener, I am sore in my quads afterwards. Should my quads be dominating this exercise? I feel like my abs should be doing the work to bring the carriage back in. What kind of cues can I give myself to help transfer the work from my quads? I'm only capable of doing about 5 reps each leg, so I don't think I'm overdoing it. Thanks for your help in explaining the muscles and how they relate to the exercises. It's very helpful to me. Well, you are very welcome. This is a great, great question, and I think it's something that as instructors, we want to check in with our clients, because a lot of times people will feel something and they assume that that's the right place to feel it. So, you know, giving them an open-ended question to have them check in with their body and saying something like, you know, where do you feel this? That's going to give them freedom to express themselves. It's going to demand, in a nice way, that they listen to their bodies and see where they feel it. You'll be surprised at how many clients go, I don't know, all over, or just weird, vague answers where they just clearly are not able to connect with their body. So remember that this mind-body connection, that's what we want them to touch and find out. So they have to actually, and this sounds so silly to most of you because you guys are already probably very connected, but they have to learn the skill of connecting to their body and feeling and articulating where they're feeling it. And that's a huge, huge thing for a lot of people. That's a huge skill. So don't underestimate that, because when you get new clients, that are maybe not in touch with their body, I don't want it to come as a shock to you. So it's important to make them connect to it, not just say something like, do you feel this? And they say yes, and you move on. No, make them answer it. Give an open-ended question. Now, you are 100% right. It should be abdominals. And by abdominals, I really mean psoas. Okay, so psoas should be causing, and some rectus abdominis, but causing the slight flexion of the pelvis to tuck under and scoop and pull the leg under. Okay, so rectus abdominis does a subtle amount by pulling, and it doesn't have a lot of movement, but there is some attempt there and some force going on at that tucking the pelvis. But specifically, the most dominant thing that is moving that carriage in should be psoas major, because not only it feels like abs, okay, so that's where it gets a little tricky, but it crosses the hip joint and does that hip flexion above 90 degrees, which is what you're really doing on arabesque. Okay, so here's a couple tips, because this is very, very common to have the quads dominating. What's happening is you're using your rectus femoris hip flexor as the mover instead of the psoas hip flexor. Okay, this is very, very common. Most people, especially, again, this is a stereotype, especially if they tend to do a lot of cardio type activity, tend to be very, very, did I say very, dominant in their quads. And when we say quads, we really only mean rectus femoris, because the other three quads only cross the knee joints. So they actually don't do any hip flexion. Go back, first off, to the knee fold movement principle. And in there, you want to see, put your fingers on that hip crease and see if you can do the exercise without that hip flexor, rectus femoris, popping up. Some encouragement I have there is that it took me a very long time to get that. Which a couple surefire ways to see if people are cheating is if when they do that, if their foot comes up like in a tabletop, you know that they're doing rectus femoris, because rectus femoris also does knee extension, so it's going to maintain that. So cue them, or if you're doing it yourself, think about your heel being like floppy against the back of your thigh, so letting that knee extension be out of the picture. That's going to encourage you to get the psoas focus. Another cue that will help you with that is to think of it from your inner thigh. Now, it's not your inner thigh muscles. It's not adductors. Actually, psoas major does some adduction, and he attaches right really high up in on that thigh bone on the inside. So that's why it does have that element of adduction, but it's not an adductor like in the group adductors that you usually think adductor magnus and brevis and all that pectineus and stuff. That's not, it's not one of those is what I mean. And that's not going to cause the movement, because those don't do hip flexion, but psoas major does both. So focusing on that, sometimes I will give an image of like if there was a piece of like cardboard or like a wall between your legs that you're trying to press your inner thigh into that as it draws up. You know, you could put your hand there as an instructor, give them some feedback or something. Obviously, you can't have a wall literally between their legs, but that idea. Okay, so when you're applying that concept, that movement principle, to this exercise, some things that can help. First off, I would make sure you've found that connection somewhere before this. That would help them a lot, you know, in an earlier exercise in their session. I would also add some weight. So say you're doing it on one red, I would do it on a red and a blue. If you're doing it on a red and blue, maybe do it on a red, blue, and a yellow, or two reds or something. That's going to make it easier to draw the carriage in, because the springs are going to be pulling the carriage in. And with that help, it's going to make it easier for you to find this new muscle choice of psoas major, not rectus femoris. Okay, so this is neurologically, you're choosing a different pathway. You're sending a different message to a different muscle to create the same movement. And it's going to feel weird and retarded for a while as that neurological pathway develops. But it will come. Make it easier for yourself, though. Maybe don't go out as far. Maybe don't have your other leg as high. Don't worry about those things as much. And just focus on the in. And think of the in coming from the tucked under pelvis. You know, really like you're a bad dog feeling. And that's going to help, again, connect into that flexion of the torso, which is another movement that psoas does. Usually when you do that, the back or the leg that's up in the air will start to droop. So give yourself grace, let that part go for a while, and really focus on finding your psoas, and it'll come back. Okay, so I want to put a few more words on this. The person that sent us in also mentioned a couple episodes ago about when they do the roll-up that their feet come up in the air. This is the same issue. Okay, so this is the same thing. If you have a client that when they do a roll-up, their legs fly up in the air like they're trying to do a teaser or something, this is the same thing. It's rectus femoris trying to work instead of psoas as much. So, again, you'll see this in lots of different places. Another really great focusing place on getting psoas, not rectus femoris, one of my favorites, is the flat back version of the kneeling abdominal series, the ones with your hands on the frame facing the pulleys. And that is an awesome, awesome version. So, you know, I think that if you can't do that on a red and a blue, that probably you want to work towards that, because that should be no problem. No shoulders involved, just pure hip flexion. And again, it'll feel like abs, which is why you know it's psoas, because abs don't create hip movement. They only create torso flexion. That would be, you know, the rectus abdominis we're talking about. So getting it isolated that it's only hip movement, flat back, and it feeling like abs, you know you've got it in the right place. So that might be an easier exercise or just an additional one to practice the same concept on, and hopefully that helps. Let me know what you think about those cues I gave you, and when you try them out, how they feel. Some of these questions tonight were about specific exercises or the muscles. Some of them were about instructors doing it versus clients doing it, and I think it's all important, because you know what? Your body is your playground as an instructor to learn this stuff and find these connections so that then you can help explain them better. And that's why I think it's so, so important. And we have such a huge emphasis on self-practice for the P3 program that I want to emphasize that. That should be something that's just a training ground so that you have self-practice throughout your career. So if you're not getting that, I can't emphasize enough that that's going to really help all this stuff, which obviously the instructors that send in these questions are doing that. So kudos to you. And I just want to say thanks for the great questions. Keep them coming in.
Thanks for listening to this P3 podcast. If you liked it, please go to iTunes and rate it. You can also subscribe to our program on iTunes so that you don't miss a single episode. I want to leave you with a final message to keep in mind this week. Everyone deserves to enjoy movement, and you're the one that can help them do it.